North, east, south, and west, this is Monitor, gathering place for all of the information of major importance in the world that we live in, the New World. ALCAP staff here in Radio Central on the eve of the start of the United States Supreme Court's new fall term. On radio yesterday and in the morning newspapers today, the nation learned that President Eisenhower had nominated Judge William Joseph Brennan, Jr. of New Jersey to the Supreme Court seat to be vacated next month by Justice Sherman Minton, who is retiring. For the bearing of this nomination on the coming court term and a look at some of the other problems facing our highest court, Monitor turns to the University of Chicago Law School to hear the views of men with both detailed training and practical first-hand knowledge of Supreme Court procedures. The next voice you'll hear is that of our new guide for several New World adventures, Dean Morris F.X. Donahue of the University of Chicago.
Yes, Mr. Capstaff, tomorrow the Supreme Court of the United States opens in Washington its 167th year. It is an august institution for Americans, the symbol of the judicial part of our three-branch system of government. The nine justices meet tomorrow in especially dramatic circumstances, with the attention of the country focused on the court because of the intense interest, even controversy, and some criticism over major decisions of recent years. To discuss the new term of the court, we assemble around our New World microphone this morning three distinguished legal scholars, Mr. Philip Kurland and Mr. Allison Dunham, both began their legal careers as law clerks to justices of the Supreme Court. And actually, they are co-editors of a new book called Mr. Justice, which contains interesting biographical essays on nine former justices, a book which was published only last Tuesday. Mr. Brainerd Curry, an especially familiar voice to many of our listeners, is a former dean of the University of Pittsburgh Law School. All three of our guests are now professors of law at the Law School of the University of Chicago. Gentlemen, the newspapers this morning are full of news about the court, aren't they?
Yes, of course. The rarity of recess appointments, that is, appointments to the court by the president, while the Senate is not in session and not able to exercise its usual powers of confirmation, raises some very interesting questions and some constitutional matters.
Curry, I suppose we ought to get clear the authority to make the recess appointment.
Now, what is that authority, Mr. Dunham?
Authority's in the Constitution. Of course, any permanent appointment to the Supreme Court, as with many other jobs, must be confirmed by the Senate. And all that the President technically has done yesterday in his announcement was to indicate his intention to nominate Mr. Brennan to the Supreme Court and a further intention to make a recess appointment, which he will undoubtedly do about the time that Mr. Justice Minton steps down.
Well, Mr. Dunham, suppose that the new justice is not confirmed by the new session of the Senate. What will the situation then be?
Well, the recess appointment lasts until Congress adjourns, or until the Senate adjourns, rather, since it's the Senate that makes the confirmation. And it can be made only when the Senate is not in session. The Constitution provides that he may serve, after he undertakes the recess appointment, until the end of the congressional term, so that could be until December, although most likely it will be about the time this term of court adjourns, sometime in June or July.
And Mr. Kurland, are there advantages and disadvantages in this situation?
Well, there certainly are. The President faced a real problem in making the decision as to whether he would make a recess appointment. If no appointment is made, the court faces the difficulty of an evenly divided court on many important issues which it will have to decide in the coming year. And what's more, they will have to do a job which is a demanding job for nine justices, a demanding job both physically and intellectually, with only eight justices. If an appointment is made, the problem which is created is a possibility of a quick change of personnel in the event the Senate does not confirm. And even when the nominee gets before the Senate for approval, the Senate committee will have before it a series of decisions in which that nominee has participated, with the result the nominee may be in the position of having to render his decisions with the knowledge that he's going to have to seek Senate confirmation.
And later on, perhaps even have to defend before the Senate what he's already done.
Well, I don't think, I think he will be free to say that he's not going to talk about his decisions before the Senate. That's, there's precedent for that. Mr. Justice Holland, for example, on his nomination, refused to talk about issues which would come before the court.
But your old chief, Mr. Frankfurter, did talk, didn't he, sir, before
the court? Well, he was pressed rather hard on that point.
And now, Mr. Curry, is there any precedent for a situation in which a justice serves on a recess basis and then is not confirmed?
Well, there's one precedent. Recess appointments are rare. They're not non-existent. And early in our history, we had a rather dramatic instance of a recess appointment which ultimately failed of confirmation. President Washington appointed John Rutledge of South Carolina to succeed our first Chief Justice, John Jay. And Chief Justice Rutledge sat through a term, heard cases, but then when the Senate convened, it declined confirmation.
165 years ago. Well, gentlemen, what can we say about the composition of the court as Mr. Minton, as Mr. Justice Minton, Minton leaves it, and as Mr. Brent, and as Mr. Brennan comes on?
Well, if the political labels mean anything, Donahue, there's really no change in the composition. As the newspapers pointed out, Mr. Brennan being a Democrat, it leaves the court with six Democrats and three Republicans, since Minton was also a Democrat, having been appointed by Truman. I think the experience of the court, however, is such that political labels don't mean very much after a man gets on the court.
I think that's true, Dunham. If we look at the dissents of last term as an indication of this, we see that there were three groupings. The first...
Before you tell us that, Mr. Curling, can you tell us how closely was the court actually divided?
Well, I think
Were there many 5-4 decisions?
In 13 cases, the court was divided 5-4, and in one case, the court was divided 4-3.
Out of how many, sir?
I think there were 86 opinions last term. Is that right?
That's right. There were 86 opinions, and I think there was an increase in dissenting votes, but a decrease in the number of cases in which there were dissents last year.
So that actually in about 1/6 of the cases, a single vote decided it.
Right.
Yes, Mr. Curlin, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that the court is divided into approximately three groups, each of the three having a person with the party label Republican on it. The first group of Warren, Black, and Douglas, the second of Reed, Burton, and Minton, the third of Mr. Justice Frankfurter and Harlan, with Clark pretty much moving around among them.
Well, now, are these groups are those that are usually labeled moderate, conservative, liberal?
Well, I don't like those labels.
Well, give us some label.
But I suppose you might call the Warren Black Douglas group the libertarian group, or as Professor Powell used to like to call them, the libertine group. The conservative group was Reed, Burton, and Minton, I suppose, with Mr. Justice Frankfurter and Mr. Justice Holland somewhere in the middle.
I think you can make that point very effectively by reference to last year's business, but I think it also ought to be stated that throughout the court's history, it's been true that practically no discernible relationship can be established between the voting record of the justices and their previous political identification.
Well, Curry, there's a very dramatic illustration of this, I suppose, when former Chief Justice Stone's nomination came up before the court
Before the Senate
for confirmation as Chief Justice, when he had been appointed back in the late 20s, as an associate justice, some members of the Senate opposed his confirmation, although he was confirmed, but they opposed it on the ground that he was likely to be a conservative business lawyer, as they put it. When the confirmation came up some 20 years later, the question came up for his chief justiceship, Senator Norris of Nebraska, who was the only one of this group of dissenters in the Senate left, more or less made a public apology, because in the intervening period, Stone had joined the what was then called the liberal group of Brandeis and Holmes and later Cardozo, and was now known as a liberal judge, although he started his career on the court with the label conservative judge, and his work on the court didn't bear that out.
Well, gentlemen, what has the court been doing since it recessed last June? What has it been doing this summer?
Well, it's been working rather hard. As Curlin knows, the judges and their law clerks over the summer spend their time reading cases that are filed during vacation in order to determine whether they should hear the cases when the court convenes tomorrow.
And are these individual decisions by individual justices?
Well, each of the judges reads all of the cases that are filed. There were some 375 filed over the summer during this vacation, and they meet after they have read them and decide whether they should hear the case. Most of the cases come in what is called a petition for certiorari, and the court does not have to take the case, and the practice is that if four judges think the case should be argued before the court and decided on the merits, the court then takes the case and hears it. So they have some 400 cases to consider tomorrow, or around 375, and during the year they will have more than 1,500 cases.
And Mr. Minton stays on the court till October 15th in order to...
I think the reason for his staying on the court is that he has done the work on over the summer and will therefore cast his vote on the question of whether a case should or should not be entertained.
Is the court now abreast of its business?
Yes, for many years they have ended their term abreast of their business in the sense that all cases that were argued have been disposed of during the term of the court.
What volume of work is there? How many cases are attempted to be brought to the attention of the court? Do you know, Mr. Curry?
Oh, last year there were some 1,800, which represented a substantial increase over the previous year.
And of those, how many were argued? How many were decided on the merits?
Oh, 220 some odd.
I see. Now, what is necessary, Mr. Curlin, to get a case argued before the court?
Well, the court doesn't sit for purposes merely of correcting error in the decisions below. The court's interested in cases which have importance to persons other than the litigants. That is, cases of constitutional importance or for some other reason have nationwide impact. And so when the person seeking review in the court comes to the court, he must make out a showing that his case will have a wide effect on the law of the country.
Now, I suppose the attention of the country has been focused on the court primarily because of the segregation cases. What can we look for on this matter?
Well, it should be made clear that the court does not pass on questions in the abstract. And until such time as there is presented to the court a specific case which it thinks it raises important questions, there will be no decision from the court on segregation. Now, the court will have the opportunity in the coming term to decide whether or not it will entertain some segregation cases.
But you do not regard this as being either necessary or inevitable?
Certainly not.
I mean, you gentlemen all agree that the court, in effect, will ignore all the criticism that has been heard, especially in the South, on the issue of segregated schools and wait for a case to come up in the routine order of business.
Certainly, that's true. I think it ought to be made clear that criticism of the court is neither new nor very remarkable. The court's been subject to criticism of one sort and another since its founding, and that was inevitable in view of the high function of the court. It's called on to settle controversies as to the limits of authority of the national government on the one hand and the states on the other, and as to the respective branches within the federal government.
Well, Mr. Curry, what other cases have provoked criticism of the court? What are the recent cases?
Well, much of the criticism has been directed to decisions of the court which uphold national power at the expense of state power, and this has been a subject of comment. Actually, this is a very old problem, a perennial problem with the court.
Now, can I mention a leading case, Mr. Curry?
Well, there was the case of Steve Nelson, who was formerly a communist, I believe, who was prosecuted in the state courts of Pennsylvania for alleged plotting to overthrow the government of the United States by force. The court's decision was that Congress, having acted in the passage of the Smith Act to control that precise type of subversive activity, that there was no room for state legislation in the field.
I think, Curry, that brings out a rather nice contrast between the criticism of the court on the segregation cases and the Nelson case and the other case last year that provoked so much criticism.
What case was that, Mr. Dunn?
That was Cole against Young, involving the question of the power of the executive to summarily dismiss an employee whose loyalty was challenged.
You emphasize the word summarily. What do you mean, Mr. Dunn?
Well, that's dismissing him without a hearing.
I see.
But the Civil Service Act, with exception of this amendment, usually provides for a hearing when an employee is dismissed. But both of these cases involve really questions of statutory construction, unlike the segregation cases, which were constitutional. And if the people don't like the segregation cases, they have to go through a constitutional amendment. But in these two cases, all that happened was the court struggling without any congressional help, trying to determine what Congress really meant some years ago when it passed the legislation, and if Congress doesn't like what they did, it takes a simple act of Congress to restate what Congress intended.
It should be pointed out that Congress has not undertaken any change of the rules which were laid down in either the Nelson case or the Cole
case. As a result of these two cases?
There's not only the fact that Congress has only to make its intention clear, there's also the fact to be noted that this is a type of question that arises repeatedly before the court for the same reason. For example, at the last term, at almost the same time that it decided the Nelson case in Pennsylvania in favor of federal power, it decided in a labor case involving Wisconsin that the congressionally enacted Taft-Hartley Act did not preclude the states from enjoining mass picketing. So the decisions go both ways from time to time.
Are you gentlemen saying that the criticism that one frequently hears, that the Supreme Court is diminishing the rights of the states, is moving into areas hitherto controlled by the states, is really not accurate or fair?
I would put it this way. The best justification for the decisions that the court makes is found in the opinions which the judges carefully write to explain their actions. Very few people outside the legal profession get to see those opinions. They read the newspapers, and the reasons for the Supreme Court's action are frequently distorted and misunderstood. And if we can help to make it clear that there are reasons, although there's frequently disagreement within the court itself, I think we take a little of the harmfulness out of this kind of uninformed criticism.
Do you agree, Mr. Carone?
Well, I agree, and I don't know if this is the medium for it, but I think that the news sources have not fairly reflected the content of the Supreme Court's activity.
There's an observation to be made about that loyalty program case, Cole against Young, that bears this out. The effect of the Supreme Court's decision, in fact, the explicit statement of the court, was that an executive order issued by the president extending this summary dismissal procedure to all departments, whether they were involved sensitive positions or not, was an unlawful order, that the president's executive order was not in compliance with the act of Congress. Now, the justice of the court who wrote that opinion invalidating President Eisenhower's executive order was Mr. Justice Harlan, an appointee of President Eisenhower's. And the opinion was concurred in by Chief Justice Warren, also an appointee of President Eisenhower.
You gentlemen would seem to say that the so-called civil rights cases in the last term really turned on procedural arguments as to what Congress really intended and did not constitute any sort of a new flaming restatement of the civil rights position of the court or of the country.
They're not what we'd call procedural. They're problems of construing the language which Congress has put into a statute.
But in the Cole case, for example, the court did not hamstring the power of Congress to provide for the dismissal of security risks from government jobs. It simply found that Congress had not authorized for non-sensitive jobs the summary kind of procedure which curtailed the normal right to hearing and review on appeal.
Mr. Curlin, what can we look for in this new term of the court, which begins tomorrow?
Well, the court has already got on its docket some 50-odd cases. And among those are some which will raise newspaper interest, I think. There are a large number of cases arising under the Smith Act prosecutions of the minor officials.
Can you remind us what the Smith Act is, Mr. Curlin?
Well, the Smith Act is the one which is generally labeled as the Anti-Communist Act, which prohibits the preaching of sedition. And as most people know, the main communist trial was brought up to the Supreme Court several years ago, and the constitutionality sustained.
And what else can we look for, sir?
Among the other cases are a large number of labor cases involving the construction of the Taft-Hartley Act, one or two major antitrust cases, and the usual bunch of Federal Employers Liability Act cases with which the court continues to burden itself for some unknown reason.
That's injuries to railway employees.
Right.
And on segregation, we still don't know if the court will accept any new cases.
Well, there's a possibility that they will. There are applications for them to entertain such cases, but so far as I know, there's been no decision reached to take the cases out.
And we can expect some criticism to flow from these major cases no matter what the decision is. Actually, on the whole subject of for criticism, you gentlemen have pointed out to me in Warren's Standard History of the Supreme Court this passage which quotes a lawyer in the anxious days of the Republic just before the Dred Scott case 99 years ago. And this lawyer, discussing the court, said, "Admit that the federal judiciary may in its time have been guilty of errors, that it has occasionally sought to wield more power than was safe, that it is as fallible as every other human institution. Yet it has been and is a vast agency for good. It has averted many a storm which threatened our peace and has lent its powerful aid in uniting us together in the bonds of law and justice. Its very existence has proved a beacon of safety. And now we turn to it instinctively for protection. And let us ask ourselves, with all its imagined faults, what is there that can replace it? Strip it of its power, and what shall we get in exchange? Discord and confusion, statutes without obedience, courts without authority, an anarchy of principles, and a chaos of decisions, till all law at last shall be extinguished by an appeal to arms." Now, this morning we have been discussing the new term of the United States Supreme Court, and I have to thank Mr. Philip Curlin, Mr. Allison Dunham, Mr. Brainerd Curry, all of the University of Chicago Law School. This is Maurice F.X. Donahue at the University of Chicago, returning you to Monitor in Radio Central.
Many thanks, gentlemen, for an expert view on the coming Supreme Court term. Next week, with Dean Maurice Donahue again substituting for our regular guide on these weekly New World adventures, Professor Edward W. Rosenheim, Jr., we'll hear many observations on the current enthusiasm for books about the Civil War. All this and more every weekend on the Monitor Beacon. Take one.